This is The Morning Show. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson in for Kate Archer Kent. A Milwaukee Circuit Court judge ruled late last month that former Wauwatosa police officer Joseph Mensa can be prosecuted for fatally shooting 25-year-old Jay Anderson Jr. as he sat in his car in 2016. Anderson was the second of three people Mensa killed while with the Wauwatosa police. Following Anderson's death, prosecutors declined to file charges. Here's Anderson family attorney Kimberly Motley speaking to WPR.
Had the Jay Anderson shooting had been properly investigated, then it's highly likely that Alvin Cole would still be here today. And that is something that can never be made right, ever.
Judge Glenn Yamahiro said there is probable cause that Mensa committed homicide and recommended that the case get a second look under John Doe laws. And we want to hear from you. Have you been following the Mensa case? Do you work in law enforcement? Does this judge's decision affect your department? What do you think? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Sami Namula is an anthropologist and associate professor at Emory University. She is a member of the Milwaukee National Lawyers Guild, which is closely following this case. Samina, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me this morning.
And attorney Art Heitzer is also with the Milwaukee National Lawyers Guild. Art, welcome to you as well.
Thank you much, JC. Good morning.
So, Art, take us back to 2016 when then Wauwatosa police officer Joseph Mensa encountered and later shot and killed Jay Anderson Jr. What do we know happened that night?
Well, we know that Jay Anderson was asleep, apparently inebriated, in his car in a park, Madison Park in Wauwatosa, and about 3 a.m., Officer Mensa came into the park, identified the vehicle, and within 5.5 minutes, I hate to be gross about it, but essentially executed Mr. Anderson, shot him 4 times. According to the medical examiner's report, it was a homicide. And from one side of the head to the other, ear to ear, temple to temple, two bullets clearly killed him on the spot. And then, according to Wisconsin law, any investigation is supposed to be done by an outside police agency, in this case, City of Milwaukee Police did it because Wauwatosa Police is where Mensa was working. And both Professor Mola and I attended online or otherwise, I think it was 4 hearings, detailed testimony with expert witnesses with 122 years combined experience testified that Mensa violated many rules, really induced a sense of jeopardy, and really killed Jay Anderson without a reasonable basis to do so, I guess is one way to put it. And so the judge reviewed that evidence in detail in his decision on July 28th, I believe it was, and said that there was probable cause to believe that he recklessly used a fatal weapon and resulted in the death of Jay Anderson.
So, Samina, I'm going to turn to you now. You know, Art just talked about how we got from 2016 to last month, and Milwaukee County Circuit Court Judge Glenn Yamahiro recommended that there was probable cause to criminally charge Mensa. You know, we heard a little bit of that laid out, but this is under John Doe laws that we're now getting this investigation reopened. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. And before I start off, I just want to mention that, you know, we heard from attorney Kimberly Motley at the beginning of the segment that I also want to recognize that there is a family, Jay Anderson Jr.'s family, along with the families of Antonio Gonzalez and Alvin Cole, who have really been at the heart of this whole process, who have been suffering for all of these 6 years. So we can talk technicalities, but we have to remember that all of these processes are being driven by a family that has suffered a great loss and a loss that over time has appeared to be more and more senseless. So we have these John Doe statutes that have been around since 1969. that are part of our Wisconsin Assembly Bill 603, if anyone wants to look it up. There have been other John Doe hearings in the past. And what those hearings allow is if a prosecutor refuses to decline and there is evidence that was not considered in the original decision issued by a prosecutor, a group of litigants may ask for that evidence to be heard by a judge. And that is exactly what happened in this particular case. Art already referenced these hearings started on February 25th of this year. And Attorney Motley, who was representing Jay Anderson Jr.'s family, really did a copious amount of discovery, meaning she grabbed records through Freedom of Information Act laws that allow us to look at police records. And she looked into what exactly transpired in terms of the investigation into Jay Anderson Jr.'s death at the hands of Joseph Mensa. That was never disputed. And as this evidence came out, the interviews, the reports, the internal documentation or the lack of documentation in the Wauwatosa Police Department, the very cursory interviews conducted, unfortunately, by the police department in the city of Milwaukee, it became very clear that there had been a very surface-level investigation. And there were many irregularities in the investigation that really suggested that there hadn't been an adequate look into the circumstances under which Joseph Mensa had killed Jay Anderson Jr.
Can you talk a little bit about what some of those inconsistencies were?
Absolutely. So Art has already mentioned that the city of Milwaukee Police Department had the duty to conduct the investigation from the very beginning. We see that Wauwatosa Police Department made several moves to actually, I would use the word tamper with the crime scene. They allowed Officer Mensa to move his car. There are many questions also about the use of dash cam footage, the existence of the dash cam footage, the use of Officer Mensa's appropriately using or following squad video policy. So there is footage that should exist that doesn't. There is some body cam footage, but there is also an unexamined claim that initially Officer Mensa's body cam didn't work. So there are curious holes in the evidence. There was the movement of a gun, which was said to be in Jay Anderson Jr.'s possession, had been moved by the time the city of Milwaukee Police Department arrived, which is very, very disturbing. And there was no documentation or photography of the crime scene. None of these facts were then reviewed by the DA's office in the city of Milwaukee, which is also very concerning, nor the city of Milwaukee DA or the county, I should say, DA's office review any of the existing policies of the Wauwatosa Police Department, which would have been very relevant in determining the outcome of this case. So for those reasons, Judge Yamahiro very easily saw that there were many matters of fact for him to review in order to determine that there was probable cause.
We're talking to anthropologist Samina Mulla right now and attorney Art Heitzer. They're both members of the Milwaukee National Lawyers Guild, which has been closely following the case of former Wauwatosa police officer Joseph Mensa, who shot and killed Jay Anderson Jr. in 2016 at the time prosecutors declined to file charges there. Now, are there times and occurrences where a police officer is justified to use lethal force, and was that appropriate here?
Well, of course, that can happen. The evidence here is, and the phrase that at least one of the experts used was basically an officer-induced fear or jeopardy. So Officer Mensa, from what we do know, and again, as Professor Mull explained, there's a lot of evidence that was not preserved before the investigative agency, Milwaukee Police, was there. But what we do know is that he violated policy by not parking his vehicle behind the vehicle of Jay Anderson. which put him at a disadvantage, and that he failed to put on the emergency lights to warn Anderson that clearly was a police situation. And that also meant that the camera was not activated, so those records are unavailable. As Professor Mellis said, there was some assertion that one of the recording devices didn't work, but there was no report at the time that didn't work. They checked in the morning. It was never checked later on to see any evidence that it was not functioning. So the credibility of the officer is problematic there. And on top of all this, the officer called for backup. He could have waited for backup, but instead he inserted himself to try to escalate a confrontational situation with someone who evidently was unconscious, falling back asleep, etc. And because Jay Anderson's hands were not continuously held up, but sometimes would be lapsed to his lap, and then Mensa told him to bring him up again, and that happened three or four times, and then on the fourth or fifth occasion, he was executed. So many things could have been done to de-escalate and really avoid this confrontational situation, but instead bullets were fired family within a few minutes.
Now, there were reports, though, that that Anderson did have a gun in his car at the time. Is that something that everyone is keeping in mind during this conversation, certainly as we move from 2016 to now?
Yeah, of course, it's not illegal in Wisconsin to have a gun. There was a gun on the passenger's seat, and as Professor Mellis said, the Tulsa police removed that gun. We don't even know if it was loaded or not because of the tampering with the evidence. But there's no concrete evidence. So the officer's claim that he shot Anderson because Anderson was lunging towards the gun. No claim that he ever touched the gun. And all the scientific evidence at the scene indicates that Anderson remained sitting in his driver's seat, probably unconscious or close to unconscious, and no evidence that he had moved towards the gun. And that's all based on where blood was found, et cetera, and the angles of the bullets that went in.
We are talking about probable cause and the future of police investigations with longtime attorney, Milwaukee attorney Art Heitzer, and anthropologist Samina Mullah. And have you been following the case of former Wauwatosa police officer Joseph Mensa? What do you think about what we have learned from this case so far? What would you like to see happen? Call 800-642-1234. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. A special prosecutor will be appointed before the end of next month in the case of former Wauwatosa police officer Joseph Mensa. We're discussing this case and the ramifications on police investigations over criminal negligence and probable cause on The Morning Show. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Last month, a Milwaukee judge ruled that there is probable cause to charge Joseph Mensa in the 2016 shooting of Jay Anderson Jr., who was sitting in a parked car in a Wauwatosa park at the time of his killing. And we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about this case? What do you think of the precedent it might set? Call in now, 800-642-1234. Our guests are Milwaukee attorney Art Heitzer and anthropologist Samina Mullah. They're both with the Milwaukee National Lawyers Guild. Now, Samina, I want to ask really quickly, I just mentioned that there is going to be a special prosecutor appointed. Can you tell us what's going to be happening over the next 60 days with this case?
At the end of this period, or sometime in this period, Judge Yamahiro will appoint a special prosecutor. That special prosecutor will then review the evidence, and it will be up to that special prosecutor to decide whether or not to file criminal charges. Now, a probable cause hearing only has to meet a probable cause standard, whereas when we're talking about a criminal case, the special prosecutor will be using a much higher standard, that of reasonable doubt, to decide whether and what charges to issue. And so sometime after that 60 days, I think it will take, there's a copious amount of evidence, as we've noted, to review. It will take a diligent prosecutor many days to issue a decision. And they can choose not to issue a decision.
And what kind of burden of proof will, a prosecutor, if they ultimately decide to charge him criminally, Mensa criminally, what burden of proof will they have to make a conviction?
They will have to be able to prove to a jury beyond a reasonable doubt, right? Which is not no doubt, as someone who sat through many, many jury trials can tell you, but beyond a reasonable doubt that Officer Mensa is responsible for some category of what we call negligent handling of a deadly weapon that led to homicide. And so they will likely be using the standard of what an objectively reasonable officer would do, which is something we heard a lot throughout the hearing. What would an objectively reasonable officer do? And we heard from many experts, including some who were former members of the Milwaukee Police Department, like Sergeant Pamela Holmes, and then many other kind of nationally trained experts, that that every action that we know Joseph Mensa took was very unreasonable.
I want to go to our callers right now. We have Henry in Milwaukee. Hi, Henry.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. What did you want to say?
I wanted to say that I know the stress and the predominant discussions tend to bring up race. But I'm always hoping that race will be secondary. The main event is the legalities or the illegalities that took place. I'm always hoping that procedures, the process, the performance of the officer is emphasized the most.
Henry, thank you so much for that call. Art, I'll turn to you. What is your reaction there?
Well, I think Henry's comment is really on point. In this case, there were very clear procedures, not only that Officer Mensa should have followed but failed to, but the Wauwatosa police did not follow normal standards. As was mentioned, this is not the only one. This is one of three killings, fatal shootings by Officer Mensa. And there are standards when that happens to make sure the officer is in a reasonable shape to return without putting anyone at risk. And Wauwatosa Police Chief and Department didn't follow that at all. And as I said earlier, Officer Mensa did not park his vehicle behind Jay Anderson's vehicle, didn't turn on the emergency lights, failed to keep an objective record by taping what was going on, and didn't wait for backup, et cetera, et cetera. And what I think is important from the judge's decision at the end, he said what many of us think is kind of obvious, but it's still an unresolved situation in Wisconsin. To rely on a sister a police department, in this case, Milwaukee Police Board and Wauwatosa Police, and to rely on a district attorney in the same area, all of them have to rely on each other for cooperation, whether it's prosecution or backup or somebody crossing from Wauwatosa to Milwaukee or vice versa. To rely on them to be arguably objective in investigating is just not reasonable. And
now,
the judge said, if you want to really have accountability, we have to look at a different structural approach. Go ahead.
Sure. Let's stick with that accountability, because there has been a spotlight on these officer-involved shootings over the last few years. We just saw what happened in Minnesota with George Floyd and the Derek Chauvin case. We now have focus on this Joseph Mensa case. We only have about a minute left. What kind of structural changes or reforms could we see come out of this?
Well, I mean, one thing would be, having like an independent investigator who is not beholden to or reliance on or cooperation with the police department in question. Another is, you know, we talk a lot about qualified immunity, so that officers and their departments can be liable when they violate their own procedures and resulting in terrible injury or in death to a citizen without apparent justification.
Well, Art and Samina, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you both so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
Samina Mullah is an associate professor at Emory University. Art Heitzer is a Milwaukee attorney. Both are members of the Milwaukee National Lawyers Guild. Up next is news. Then thousands of people were without power this week after storms tore through Wisconsin. We'll talk about storm damage and how people can stay safe when bad weather hits. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson in for Kate Archer Kent. Right now, we're talking about severe weather and how you and your family can stay safe when bad weather strikes. This week, we have seen a string of severe thunderstorms tear through the state. And when there are thunderstorms, we do have a chance for tornadoes. And there have been some confirmed cases this week about tornadoes touching down in the state. And we want to hear from you. Did your power go out during this week's storms or last week's? How long did it take for it to be restored? What part of the state do you live in? And how do you and your family handle safety around bad weather? Call in now, 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Andrew Beckett is the lead public information officer of Wisconsin Emergency Management. He also runs the state's Ready Wisconsin campaign, which encourages being prepared for emergencies and disasters. Andrew, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me this morning.
So we have had some really nasty storms come through the state. Let's start with power outages. As of right now, how widespread are the power outages, and are they basically they're being repaired right now?
Well, the information we have regarding power outages focuses most of them in the southeastern Wisconsin area, that Waukesha, Milwaukee, Kenosha, Racine area. And really, the utilities are working hard around the clock right now with linemen out trying to get those connections repaired. I don't have an actual estimate on when they'll be up. That would be the utilities to provide that information. But, you know, they are working really around the clock to get that work done.
And what is the typical process for restoring power after one of these storms?
Really, the utilities get out there and they assess the problems with their infrastructure and they work to repair those connections in order to make service is restored. You know, infrastructure really can be just direct connections on the actual grid, but I'm sure that with the number of trees that were down in southeast Wisconsin, you probably had a lot of direct-to-home connections that were damaged as well.
Well, sticking with that, since we do want to talk about safety and all the facets of it, when power lines are down, physically down, what should people do to make sure that they stay safe?
Sure. So first off, when you encounter down lines, the number one thing to do is to stay away from them. You have no idea what kind of current might be going through those lines. You want to make sure you're reporting that to the local utility as quickly as possible so that they can get out there, make sure that the line is deactivated, and work to restore that connection. If you have lost power in your home, of course, you want to make sure that you're doing things like keeping your refrigerator and your freezer closed in order to preserve that temperature as much as possible because you don't know how long you may be without service. Really, if you've had more than 24 hours without power, you really want to be carefully assessing any food that may have been in there, especially things that are susceptible to spoiling. So, you know, really the real bit of advice there is when you're in doubt, throw it out, because you have no idea of knowing whether or not something is safe to eat that may have been unrefrigerated for a long period of time. In addition, if you have a generator, you want to make sure that you are running that as it's intended to be run, not inside an enclosed space, not inside your home. Typically, generators need to be run outside in a well-ventilated area in order to reduce the risk of carbon monoxide exposure.
Now, sticking just with power outages, the state has seen some severe heat this week. How concerned are you with the power outages for heat-related illnesses?
We are always concerned when temperatures rise like this if there is power out. We want to make sure that people are taking every precaution they can to take care of themselves, as well as any elderly neighbors or individuals that may have special medical needs. Check in on those people. Make sure that they are staying cool. And if they are in trouble, make sure that they're getting to the assistance that can help them cool down, whether that's medical attention or if local areas have opened cooling centers in order to make sure that people have somewhere to stay safe, especially during the hottest parts of the day.
We are discussing severe weather with Andrew Beckett. He is the lead public information officer of Wisconsin Emergency Management. And we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about severe thunderstorms or tornadoes? What questions do you have about staying safe during a power outage? Call 800-642-1234. Now, Andrew, we were talking about thunderstorms, and so let's stick with them right now before we move on to tornadoes. What kind of danger do thunderstorms bring outside of tornadoes, which we'll get to in a second?
Sure. Well, obviously with thunderstorms, aside from tornadoes, you do have the possibility for very strong winds that can come through an area, as well as lightning dangers. And then, of course, heavy rains, which can lead to flash flooding, as well as long-term flooding if it's in a period of extreme heavy rain for over a long period of time.
Okay, now let's move to tornadoes, since those always grab headlines. We mentioned that there were definitely a few confirmed throughout the state yesterday. What sort of tornado damage have we seen so far this summer as a whole?
Well, really, we've obviously seen a very large tornado that touched down in the Bosque Belle area last week in western Wisconsin. That caused significant damage. It was one of the strongest that the state has seen in over a decade. Numerous homes destroyed and several others that had significant damage, as well as agricultural damage, tree damage, and a number of outbuildings on properties as well that saw significant damage. So, I mean, that's probably about the worst damage that we've seen from a single storm this summer. But, you know, there have been multiple tornadoes at this point. For a season that started as late as it did, we've had a very active July into August. And really, we've seen a number of areas where, thankfully, they've been weaker tornadoes, but they've damaged trees, they've damaged some buildings. So we are seeing typically what you would expect to see from a tornado. You're seeing trees and limbs downed, and you're seeing roof damage, walls sometimes taken off of homes from these powerful storms, which is why it is extremely important that when those warnings are issued for your area and you know that a tornado is possible nearby, to make sure that you are seeking shelter as quickly as possible in a safe location. That would either be the center part of your basement or in a ground floor interior room. Really, the goal is to put as much distance between you and the outside of your home as possible.
So with that, one thing I want to ask, just because people who may be on the outside don't pay too much attention to tornado warnings or to terminology, can you just explain when someone is looking at the tornado weather or news, some of the terms that they might be seeing that might, you know, get the National Weather Service to really warn people to go downstairs? Like, what is the National Weather Service, you know, putting into their calculation to issue these warnings?
Really, a lot of times with tornadoes, it is the warnings are based off of things like spotters, train spotters who are out in the fields making reports. Those can be volunteers, those could be law enforcement. You have radar indication on tornadoes. You know, there's a lot of things they look for, such as just the I'm not a radar expert, so I can't speak specifically what they may be looking for, but typically the things that I see pointed out would be things like possible rotation that shows up in the radar image, as well as signatures that may indicate there's debris in the air.
We are talking to Andrew Beckett right now. He is the lead public information officer with the Office of Wisconsin Emergency Management. He's also part of the Ready Wisconsin campaign. He runs that. And we want to hear from you. Call in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about staying safe during severe weather? You know, how do you and your family, what plans do you have put in place when severe weather is forecast? Call in now, 800-642-1234. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. We're talking about severe weather in Wisconsin and how you can stay safe. Our severe weather guide is Andrew Beckett. He's the lead public information officer with Wisconsin Emergency Management. And you can join the conversation now. Have you faced any storm damage this summer? What happened? How did you handle it? Did your home insurance cover it? And what kind of emergency preparedness plan do you have? Does your family have? Call in now, 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Now, I want to go to one of our callers right now. We have Mike in Milwaukee. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. I just want to relate something to a previous occurrence in Puerto Rico. Hurricane went through. Some hand towel, paper towels were thrown at the people, and that was it. But the rebuilding of the infrastructure in Puerto Rico, the IMF and the people that the World Trade Organization, whatever, they determine what's done with the money that they're going to borrow to Puerto Rico, and they determine that the rebuilding of the electrical infrastructure will be above ground, in spite of the fact that climate change is indicating that these storms will be more frequent and more destructive. And I'm wondering why we're not with infrastructure putting our power lines underground so that they're not so subjected to these increasing in both in frequency and intensity, that we're not preparing for those type of storms that we're going to have even here in Wisconsin.
Okay, thank you so much for that call, Mike. So that's an infrastructure question. And we talked a little bit about power lines being above ground and the danger there. Insofar as you know, are there any moves to be made to make our infrastructure just a little bit safer to maybe head off some of the severe weather we see and its aftermath?
That's not really an area where I have any expertise, so I can't really comment on that.
Okay, yeah. Thanks, Andrew. Appreciate that. So let's go back to some of the storms that we've seen in Wisconsin this week. You know, last month, Concord residents, which is just west of Milwaukee, they saw a tornado touchdown. We heard about Boscobel. How widespread has the damage been so far this summer? And have we heard anything from Governor Evers about maybe declaring an emergency or anything like that?
In regards to how widespread, I mean, obviously we have seen damage touch down in areas across the state of Wisconsin this summer. We've had the western part of the state, especially southwest, has been fairly active. We've also seen in the north and in the north central part of the state several storms, several tornadoes that have touched down in that region. I don't have the official count right in front of me in terms of the number of tornadoes that the state has seen at this point this year. I do know that we were very close to being the latest start for the year, but since then it has obviously picked up quite a bit as we've gotten into July and then to August. In terms of any declared state of emergencies, the storms that produced the tornado in Jefferson County last week, or the Boscobel area, I want to make sure I'm giving you the right information here. I do not recall if we had a declared state of emergency with those storms. But really, I want to stress that a state of emergency is really just a tool that's used in order to help free up state resources to make them move faster. As it stands right now, Wisconsin Emergency Management, the agency that I represent, we have been in contact with our local partners, the county and tribal emergency managers who work with the municipalities within their state. And at this time, the state has had no requests for assistance associated with these storms. The counties and the tribes have been working diligently and using the resources that they have at their disposal in order to make sure that their response is as effective as possible. This is the way that the system is supposed to work. They have been doing a great job of getting out there, assessing damage, and providing assistance where they can.
I want to go back to our callers, Andrew. We have Jesse in Plymouth. Hi, Jesse.
Hi.
What question did you have, Jesse?
I was wondering, so if you live in a mobile home, where is the safest place to go? If you don't have a way to anywhere safe, is there a certain room?
Sure, I can address that. So really, trailers, vehicles, mobile homes, modular homes, they're not really designed to withstand the forces that a tornado produces, even if they've got like tie downs. So really, you don't want to be inside of those. You want to get to a nearby sturdy building if one is available. Some developments do have a designated tornado shelter that's present. If you're working in somewhere like a campground, you might want to look for something like a concrete-built bathhouse. If those are not available, obviously with a tornado, the biggest concern is flying debris. That's the issue. That is what ends up injuring people is debris from construction materials, from tree limbs coming down that causes injuries. So really you want to get into as low and flat a location as possible in order to protect yourself, whether that's a ditch, some sort of embankment. You want to avoid something like if you're traveling on the interstate going up under an overpass, because those can actually collect debris during a major wind event. Really, the goal is to get yourself as low and flat as possible in order to reduce the risk of flying debris hitting you. I will caution that outdoors, there's really no truly safe place to be. The goal is to minimize the risk to yourself as much as possible. But if you don't have, or if you live in something like a mobile home and you do not have access to a shelter, that's something to investigate and include in your plan and figure out how you can identify that safe location to get to when there's severe weather in the area.
We are talking to Andrew Beckett right now. He's the lead public information officer with Wisconsin Emergency Management. And Jesse, thank you so much for that call. We also got a call from a listener who couldn't stay on. Barb from East Troy wants to know if we're safe from lightning in our cars during a thunderstorm.
Typically speaking, vehicles should be a relatively safe place to seek shelter from lightning. You want to make sure that you're not touching metal surfaces while you're inside a vehicle, but it is really a safer location than something like being under a park pavilion. Really, with lightning, the biggest danger is making sure you're in an enclosed space so that there's something between you and the outside. So something like a park pavilion, anything with open walls like a porch, is not a safe location to be during a lightning storm, because lightning doesn't necessarily travel straight up and down from the sky. It can travel in a diagonal direction as well as branch out when it touches the ground. So really you want to be inside a structure that has enclosed walls.
So, Andrew, at the end of July, I want to move to warning systems really fast. At the end of July in Fond du Lac County, there was a tornado warning. It was issued in the region, but the sirens failed to go off. What should people do, in terms of being prepared, you know, if there's severe weather, but maybe there could be a glitch? How should people prepare for that?
Sure. So when it comes to alerting systems, we encourage people to have as many ways to receive information as possible. Outdoor warning sirens are operated at the local level in the state of Wisconsin. And those systems do face problems. They're tested regularly, but sometimes issues happen. And really the most important thing people need to remember is to make sure that they have other ways to receive alerts just in case they don't hear that siren, because they're really designed to be heard by people who are outdoors. That means having something like a NOAA weather radio in your home that's programmed to the local tower frequency, having wireless emergency alerts enabled on your mobile device. That is a setting that sometimes you have to turn on. In addition to that, you can download weather apps that can provide you alerts. And then there's always trusted local media, radio and TV, that will frequently break into coverage with alert warnings or go live to discuss the storm threat for the area. I mean, really, you want to have as many of those tools in place as possible when you're tracking a storm in your area to make sure that you are getting the most up-to-date information and alerts as possible.
It feels like common sense that people, you know, who live in houses would know to go into a basement in the event of a tornado or really severe weather, you know, but sometimes in the moment you panic. How can people best prepare a plan for when severe weather happens before severe weather happens?
Absolutely. You want to make sure that you have that plan in place and you've discussed it with everyone in your family. You can find resources for doing that on our website, readywisconsin.wi.gov. There we have a number of different tips and fact sheets that can provide information on how to best create a plan that suits the needs of your family.
Now, before we wrap up, I want to turn quickly to another facet of severe weather, which is flooding. You encounter water on the streets if you're out and about. Sometimes basements get flooded. How can people stay safe in the event of flooding outside and sometimes flooding inside?
We'll talk about flooding outside first. Really, the most important piece of advice to remember there is to turn around, don't drown. If you encounter floodwaters on the roadways, do not venture into them, either on foot or in your vehicle. It really only takes a few inches of water to knock a person over if it's moving fast enough, and you never know what the surface beneath that what the ground is going to look like beneath the surface of that water. So if we've had a flash flood that's come through the area, it may have washed the road away. You may be driving your vehicle into a sinkhole and not even be aware of it because you think there's a road that was there yesterday still in place. So really, the safest thing to do is to stop. Don't enter the water. Find a different route, or at least wait until the floodwaters have receded so that you can safely pass and know what you're driving into. In your home, you want to make sure that you're getting to a safe elevation so that you're not directly in the water. You want to make sure that you are getting the water out as quickly and safely as it's possible to do so, and you're removing any construction material that may have been damaged, because mold growth, especially in something like a finished basement, can be a very real concern that can be a potential hazard to your health. The Wisconsin Department of Health Services has a great deal of information for basically how to make sure that your living space is hygienic again after it's been damaged by floodwaters. I encourage people to look on the Department of Health Services website for toolkits they have available there with that information.
Now we are in the summer months. We will be heading into cooler months. What severe weather should people be aware of as we head into fall?
Well, obviously, tornadoes and thunderstorms can still pop up in the state well into the fall months. I mean, really, tornadoes are something that in Wisconsin could and have occurred almost year-round. I think the only state only month we don't have a recorded tornado in state history is February. So really, we can have a tornado pretty much at any time of the year. So it's important for people to keep those threats in mind. Obviously, as we get into the colder months, the concern drifts more towards snow, and ice that the state may experience there. And really, a lot of the preparation lessons still apply. Working on those plans with your family before you need them is key. Making sure that you're having those discussions so that when severe weather does happen, everyone already has that ground base of knowledge to help limit the chances that they're going to panic.
Andrew, thank you so much for joining us today.
Happy to be here.
Andrew Beckett is the lead public information officer of Wisconsin Emergency Management. He joined us to talk about this week's severe weather and how you can be better prepared for dangerous storms. Just ahead, we explore the concept of never shopping again. Yep, you heard that right. Imagine a world where consumerism comes to a halt. We'll investigate that next. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.